popular, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked.
It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost seven times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing.
Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides, and that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory, make sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and them not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
It's a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas, and it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products.
What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further, so they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he is constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
The cos leather's growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There is no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking out from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals and the environment. It's yet to finish that review. Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995 but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
Some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believe this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week and another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
A new study has shown that the top 1% of Americans are responsible for 15% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. According to the study, 15 days for a household in 1/10% emits more than the lifetime of a household in the bottom 10%. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, the richest households are responsible for a vast, disproportionate share of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. According to the study published recently in PLOS Climate, the richest 10% of U.S. households are responsible for over 40% of the nation's total greenhouse gas emissions. Further, the top 1% alone account for between 15 and 17% of emissions. In order to arrive at this conclusion, study authors looked at not only household wages, but also investments to determine household wealth and their climate emissions. Doing this, lead author Jared Starr said, allowed researchers to examine how income-generating methods contribute to the climate crisis rather than focusing on consumption. Starr said in a statement, consumption-based approaches to limiting greenhouse gas emissions are regressive. They disproportionately punish the poor while having little impact on the extremely wealthy who tend to save and invest a large share of their income. Consumption-based approaches miss something important. Carbon pollution generates income, but when that income is reinvested into stocks rather than spent on necessities, it isn't subject to a consumption-based carbon tax. Starr, a sustainability researcher at University of Massachusetts, Amherst, went on to turn the traditional question of how carbon emissions are generated and their link to income on its head. Starr asked, what happens when we focus on how emissions create income rather than how they enable consumption? The study looked at 30 years of data to determine how investments can support direct and indirect emissions. The study authors examined investment income from a power plant, for instance, which produces emissions both at the power plant and downstream on the supply chain. The higher the income bracket, the higher the proportion of emissions that comes from investment income. The study found, further, white Americans had the largest carbon impact, while black households had the lowest share of emissions. researchers also looked at a group they categorized as super emitters, who create an extremely high amount of emissions per household. They found that almost all super emitters were from the top 0.1% of household income. Starr said, "This research gives us insight into the way that income and investments obscure emissions responsibility. For example, 15 days of income for a top 0.1% percentage household generates as much carbon pollution as a lifetime of income for a household in the bottom 10%. An income-based lens helps us focus in on exactly who is profiting the most from climate-changing carbon pollution and design policies to shift their behavior." According to The Hill, the wealthiest tenth of U.S. households are the source of 40% of national greenhouse gas emissions, according to research published in the journal PLOS Climate. Researchers, led by Jared Starr of the University of Massachusetts, analyzed 3 decades of household income data from 1990 to 2019. They found that during this period, the bottom 90% of households' share of emissions has fallen, while the top 10% share has increased. The wealthiest 1% of households were responsible for between 15% and 17% emissions. Starr and colleagues analyzed emissions associated with businesses owned by households they analyzed, but also factored in revenues relating to their investments. For the top 10%, investment income makes up a large share of those household emissions, between 38% and 42% in the case of the wealthiest 10%. Starr told The Hill in an exclusive interview, "The investment piece makes up an increasing share of the emissions responsibility as we look further up the income ladder." Just over 43% of the wealthiest 0.1% of households, 34%, were what the researchers dubbed super emitters, or those responsible for more than 3,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions per year. They also found wide racial disparities in responsibility for emissions, with non-Hispanic white households comprising the highest income-linked emissions and black households comprising the lowest. According to Hill, emissions also varied by age cohort, peaking between the ages of 45 and 64 and then declining. The results indicate that policymakers may have been looking at potential carbon taxes and their structure from the wrong angle. While consumer-facing carbon taxes have struggled to move from proposal to law in the U.S., an investment-based carbon tax may be more equitable, politically palatable, and equally justifiable, they wrote, while acknowledging that this would likely face pushback from the disproportionate amount of the wealthiest Americans in politics. They wrote, "By thinking of carbon as an outcome of income generation rather than just an outcome of consumption, such alternative policy solutions become possible."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new study has shown that Britain's cost of living crisis that mainly results from the government's economic policy is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. The results of the research were published by the BMJ Public Health Journal. The study showed that the cost of living crisis and sustained period of high prices will reduce life expectancy among the people across the country by 6.5% this year. The predicted increase in premature deaths from a baseline of 463 per 100,000 people to 493 per 100,000 equates to thousands of extra deaths a year in the UK. The study says that the most deprived households will experience four times the number of extra deaths than the wealthiest households, with the poorest having to spend a large proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared. Evidence shows low income is associated with poorer health, and that falls in income adversely affects health. According to last month's figures, the UK's inflation stood at 6.7%.
For me, this whole conversation is about whether I heat the house or whether I breathe, and it's so hard to describe what that feels like in real terms, because it's an immediate threat to your life.
Although it was down from a high of 11.1%, Britain's inflation still remains the highest among the member states of the group of seven. Meanwhile, there are gloomy predictions about UK's economic prospects. A report by the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics says that the UK economy will shrink this year and in 2024. It says a drop in GDP this year of 0.3% would be followed by a fall of 0.2% next year.
Now, if we look at the data that we've seen recently, obviously there can be some revisions in the GDP data. We saw quite a contraction in July. Now, we are expecting, perhaps there are some quirks in the data that we haven't seen as much industrial action recently, and there could be some technical issues and a rebound. But I think the outlook for the rest of this year is quite weak. And we see that, as you've mentioned, in the PMI surveys, both manufacturing and services moving into contraction.
There are fears that the UK is suffering from structural economic conditions. Factors related to the underlying weakness of the UK economy and the fallout from Brexit will leave the UK behind, while most other developed economies expand. The UK was also suffering from an unequal recovery that benefited better-off households, while the bottom half of the income scale continued to be affected by falling real incomes. Persistent inflation, falling real incomes of low-income households, and a shortage of workers will result in the drop in the country's gross domestic product. Cuts to government spending next year will also drag on economic growth. The central bank held rates at 5.25% at its meeting, and betting on financial markets showed investors expect there will be no change at the next meeting in November. The next move could be upwards should inflation prove to be more stubborn than the central bank's forecast predicts, despite a weakening of economic growth.
I think really what we're seeing is they are worried about the recession. They are worried about weaker growth, and they think that perhaps going into the rest of this year, inflation is likely to continue to decelerate. So what we're seeing is the lagged impact of fairly aggressive monetary tightening really starting to bite. And they're probably thinking, right, that here is a time to pause, but we don't want to get too complacent. There are still a lot of inflationary pressures ahead.
The economic crisis and persistent inflation has caused trouble for the ruling Tories in the UK. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's popularity has fallen to its lowest levels ever. Some 68% of Britons currently have an unfavorable view of the Prime Minister, the highest figure since becoming Prime Minister, while only 23% have a favorable view.
The truth is, the floor fell in for millions of families because of their economic mayhem. Yep. The classroom ceilings collapsed because he cut vital school budgets. And now the walls of our national security have been breached because they've ignored repeated warnings. No one voted for these shambles. No one voted for him. So how much more damage do the British public have to put up with before he finally finds the stomach to give them a say?
Iran has vowed a resolute response to Israel after the regime's prime minister threatened to use nuclear weapons against the Islamic Republic. Amir Saeed Iravani said Israel's threat to use nuclear weapons is a serious threat to international peace and security, and the international community must not remain indifferent or silent. The Iranian envoy urged the United Nations Security Council to denounce Israel's reckless statement. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations has also denounced Israel's nuclear threat against the country. Zahra Ershadi has called on the international community to force the regime to abandon nuclear weapons, join the NPT, and accept the IAEA safeguard system.
The Israeli regime, with the support of the United States, has consistently opposed all initiatives aimed at establishing a nuclear weapon-free zone in the Middle East. The possession of hundreds of nuclear weapons by this regime poses a severe threat to the security of the Middle East and beyond. A vivid example of this regime's outlawed action is calling for a so-called, I quote, credible nuclear threat against Iran, end of quote, which was brazenly raised by the regime's prime minister on 22nd September 2023.
Ershadi slammed Tel Aviv's irresponsible threat, which he said was against international norms and rules. Days earlier, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had addressed the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly, calling for a credible nuclear threat against Iran.
Sanctions must be snapped back. And above all, Iran must face a credible nuclear threat.
His office soon afterwards said that Netanyahu had misspoken and that his prepared text said credible military threat. Iran says the international community should reject and condemn any normalization of nuclear rhetoric and, in particular, the threat of use of nuclear weapons. Israel has a widely known but undeclared nuclear program. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, as of January, Israel was believed to possess a stockpile of around 90 nuclear warheads. But analysts believe the regime possesses 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal, making it the Middle East's sole possessor of non-conventional arms. The Tel Aviv regime has, however, refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. On the contrary, Iran has long been cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, as a signatory to the NPT. Tehran has repeatedly declared that its nuclear program remains purely peaceful as always, and that the Islamic Republic had no intention of developing nuclear weapons as a matter of Islamic and state principles. Iran proved the peaceful nature of its nuclear program to the world by signing the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, with six world powers. But the United States later quit it. Ever since the Islamic Republic of Iran decided to restart its nuclear activities after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, it has faced consistent threats from Western nations and their regional allies, especially Israel. The Tel Aviv regime has launched sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinated its nuclear scientists. Several Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2020. Israel has pressed upon its allies that Iran's program is malicious, partly as a smokescreen for its own nuclear program and its scores of undeclared nuclear warheads.
What I call in English whistleblower, to inform the world about Israel's nuclear secret, because no one speak or no one report exactly what is going there.
In 1986, Vanunu duped Israel's vaunted security apparatus and smuggled a camera into the secret Dimona plant. His photographs exposed the world's greatest nuclear cover-up. What he showed was that Israel's nuclear arms program was far bigger and much more powerful than anyone had even dreamt possible.
Enough material every year for 10 bombs.
Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has campaigned against Iran for almost 30 years. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities.
Thank you.
The U.S. President Joe Biden went on a three-day trip to Asia recently. His trip included stops in India for the G20 summit, then Vietnam to upgrade their bilateral relationship. The purpose of his trip was to enhance U.S. relationship with regional countries, especially in a G20 format. But that is just a formal way of not saying what the true intentions of the U.S. president were. For starters, Joe Biden had said that his intentions to strengthen ties with China's neighbors weren't designed to contain Beijing, a phrase that he has repeated again and again. He has said things like, "I don't want to contain China. We're not trying to hurt China. America's goal is getting the relationship right."
I am sincere about getting the relationship right. And one of the things that is going on now is China's beginning to change some of the rules of the game.
But his visit to Vietnam right after the G20 summit relayed a different message. The two countries signed a historic agreement to upgrade relations to the level of comprehensive strategic partnership. Joe Biden secured deals with Vietnam on semiconductors and minerals. So important is Vietnam for the U.S. that executives from Google, Intel, Amcor, Marvel, Global Foundries, and Boeing met with Vietnamese tech executives, along with the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, for more deals. With semiconductors, the centerpiece of an action plan adopted during Biden's visit. So what gives? Why is Vietnam so important to the U.S.? It's pretty obvious. The U.S. wants to rival China and at the same time inflict economic damage. So much for Biden saying we're not trying to hurt China. But the U.S. has other plans for Vietnam, which was not announced yet. After the U.S. and Vietnam elevated their relationship to comprehensive strategic partnership, there were reports that the U.S. and Vietnam were negotiating a major arms deal, perhaps the biggest in their history, one that would involve F-16 fighter jets. Here are some interesting facts behind U.S.-Vietnam military relationship. Since an arms embargo was lifted in 2016, U.S. arms exports to Vietnam were limited to just Coast Guard ships and trainer aircraft. So, from Coast Guard ships and trainer aircraft to F-16 fighter jets? What gives? And by the way, Russia has supplied about 80% of Vietnam's military arsenal. Yet Vietnam is just one of many countries that the U.S. has been selling military equipment to in the Asia-Pacific region. Here is one snapshot. Osprey aircraft to Indonesia for $2 billion. $2 billion in missiles and upgrades to Taiwan. $30 billion to South Korea, $2 billion in attack helicopters, as well as support boats to the Philippines, and $23.11 billion to Japan for 105 F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft and related equipment. No wonder China is angered. The U.S. actions do not match its rhetoric when it comes to China. It is clear that it wants to militarize the region, very similar to how it did with NATO countries in Europe, the target there being Russia. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman urged Washington to abandon its Cold War mentality and to refrain from provoking an arms race in Asia.
China hopes that when developing bilateral relations and conducting military cooperation, relevant countries will effectively abide by the basic norms of international relations, abandon hegemony and Cold War thinking, stop provoking confrontation and stimulating arms races.
But that has fallen on U.S.'s deaf ears. The U.S. has gone all out to align regional countries with it. Hop on issues like Taiwan, North Korea, and the disputed islands are cards that the U.S. plays to its favor to do that. But the region will soon turn into a tinderbox if it hasn't already, and it would only take one spark, like the Taiwan issue or North Korea, for it to explode. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on Israel-Saudi normalization. And here he is.
I think that under your leadership, Mr. President, we can
forge a historic peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia?
The Saudi Crown Prince seems to echo the same sentiment.
Every day we get closer. It seems it's for the first time a real one, serious. We're going to see how it goes.
Two problems here. First, just days ago, it was said that Saudi Arabia had abandoned any normalization talks with Israel, which was reported widely. Yet when the Saudi Crown Prince was asked about it, he said,
"There were reports that you had suspended talks."
No, that's not true.
The Saudi Crown Prince, however, has said the issue of Palestine is of utmost importance.
For us, the Palestinian issue is very important. We need to solve that part.
Question is, how important? Is it a non-negotiable, or is it open for negotiations?
We have a good negotiation. Let's continue.
Now comes the Saudi foreign minister, who had this to say about it at the UNGA podium. To paraphrase his statement, peace that allows Palestinian people to have an independent state with Al-Quds as its capital. If that's the case, Israel-Saudi reconciliation is a non-starter. There's no way that neither the Israeli prime minister nor his far-right extreme fascist cabinet would agree to it. So what is the deal? Why is Saudi Arabia wasting time talking to Israel? How can Netanyahu say that he cares about the Palestinian cause, yet say this about their position?
But I also believe that we must not give the Palestinians a veto over new peace treaties with Arab states.
And while talking about the importance of Palestinians, his forces murdering Palestinians. Just today, two shot in the head, bulldozing their homes and detaining them. Is Saudi Arabia serious that it may reconcile with this apartheid regime?
Credible nuclear threat.
The Israeli prime minister was up to his old antics at the UNGA podium, using his props to make a point, a red marker and a piece of cardboard.
Today I bring this marker to show a great blessing. The blessing of a new Middle East.
This new Middle East that he talks about, referred to by Iran as West Asia, has already happened. It's called the Iran-Saudi reconciliation. Further proof of that, Iran's foreign minister hooking up with the Saudi FM in New York on the sidelines of the UNGA, where there was talk about a comprehensive cooperation agreement with Riyadh. But there's no denying there is a conflict of interest when it comes to Saudi-Iran reconciliation versus a possible Saudi detente with Israel in more ways than one. And what about the U.S. and the U.S. President Joe Biden, whose hand the Saudi Crown Prince has rejected on more than one occasion? The U.S. has been more cautious than the upbeat assessment of Israel, saying things like a breakthrough is far away and steep obstacles remain. But perhaps a point overlooked by the media may provide a window into what the real intentions of the U.S. is. One of the reasons behind the U.S. enthusiasm behind denormalization, countering China's inroads in the Persian Gulf. This was a clear reference to China's Belt and Road Initiative, a stance supported by the Israeli Prime Minister.
That great promise in the G20 meeting that you participated and led, you spoke about an economic corridor that would link Asia, the Middle East, and Europe together, and such a corridor will make Israel a very important hub on a highway of unprecedented prosperity.
The U.S. and Israel, through the trade route, as shown here, want to stand up to China's One Belt, One Road initiative, and as the saying goes, kill two birds with one stone through this strategy. But will it work? Consider this. China is Saudi Arabia's number one oil customer. Saudi Arabia has just become a new BRICS member. Saudi Arabia has reconciled with Iran, with many PGCC Persian Gulf countries to have done the same or are in the process of doing that with Iran. That's called the New World Order. It would be wiser for Netanyahu to reconcile with his own people, who have protested for over 38 weeks, before aspiring to reconcile with Saudi Arabia.
While we're speaking and while we hope...
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Major General Mohammad Baqiri, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, has said that Tehran and Moscow are working on a long-term cooperation document. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu visited Tehran recently and held meetings with top Iranian military leadership, including the chief of the staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, General Mohammad Baqiri, and Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani. Shoigu, heading a high-ranking Russian military delegation, was in the Iranian capital on the official invitation of General Baqiri, who welcomed him during an impressive ceremony in Tehran. Shoigu was invited to Iran to discuss defense cooperation between the two all-weather allies. The two countries have historically been the favorite targets of Western aggression, from sabotage attacks to economic sanctions meant to destabilize their economies. Both countries have, however, held course despite all such oppressive measures and pursued independent policies to strengthen their respective economies and bolster bilateral cooperation. Shoigu and his accompanying delegation appear to be in positive spirits while meeting their Iranian counterparts. Shoigu was particularly vocal about the positive relations with Iran's top leadership. Shoigu added, as cited by local Iranian media, the pressure of sanctions on Russia and Iran is proving to be futile, while Russia-Iran cooperation is reaching new highs. The Islamic Republic's ability to operate independently and create a healthy national economy despite Western meddling has proved very fruitful. It has recently been included in the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa Economic Alliance, as well as the SCO, or Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Naturally, it is important for Iran to consider security issues to protect its interests within these organizations, and Russia is a natural ally in this context, as it is also a member of both groupings. In a growing multilateral world order, which many are referring to as multipolarity as well as the end of Americanism, cooperation based on mutual trust and benefits holds the key. However, the remnants of the dying U.S.-led unipolar world order will try to sow disorder as they fight off the inevitable new reality shaped by new emerging powers. Projects within BRICS countries as well as SCO countries have notably been subject to Western-backed sabotage. Most notable would be the destruction of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which impacts Russia's ability to deliver gas to Western Europe. Other examples include terrorist attacks on the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor by the Turkestan Islamic Party, TIP, Takfiri terrorists that were once on the U.S. list of terror groups but have since been removed as they play a role in the U.S. strategy of destabilizing targeted countries. The U.S. use of proxy forces to conduct economic sabotage and destruction is a serious threat to regional development and stability, as Iran has repeatedly warned about. Iran's induction into BRICS and the SCO means it will need to take significant steps to bolster security, as the country itself is embarking on specific projects meant to facilitate trade in the region. This includes a railway linking Iraq all the way to Syria and a gas pipeline between Iran and Pakistan. These projects will help facilitate regional independence for countries and incentivize less reliance on trade with predatory Western countries. With Iran joining two economic alliances that are going to shape the new world order, it can count on Western-backed disruption to regional projects. Despite both BRICS and the SCO being economic alliances, in order to ensure their success, the defense of their ambitious projects must be factored in. The meeting between Shoigu and Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Akbar Ahmadian, was a key moment for discussing the looming threat of Western sabotage seriously. The meeting stressed enhancing regional cooperation to achieve collective security as being one of the most effective ways to end foreign interference in the region. This is a particularly important equation. Foreign interference has either been the United States and its allies overtly or its various proxy forces covertly. As Iran and Russia strengthen the reality of the unified Eurasia, it would be in both countries' interests to secure regional interests and to expel the threat of Western sabotage completely, as implied in the latter part of the statement. A mutual understanding of the adversaries in the region is a first step that cannot be ignored. Already, Iran and Russia's incalculable assistance in Syria can prove the importance of understanding this equation. A unified effort to expel Western invaders and their proxy armies has led to a hard-fought victory for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, to the point that the Arab League and other countries that once turned their back on Syria are now being forced to accept reality. Syria is here to stay. Iran has also gained much experience lately in conducting anti-terrorist operations on its borders. It has continued its liquidation of Daesh networks on its borders, not to mention years of experience fighting Daesh terrorist forces in Iraq and Syria. Recently, Iranian intelligence forces thwarted at least 30 bombings at populous areas of the capital Tehran, arresting 28 operatives affiliated with the Daesh Takfiri group. In this arena, Iran is highly skilled. Iranian intelligence services have also been fiercely exposing and shutting down internal terror networks associated with terrorist organizations such as MKO, all the way to separatists and Mossad. Russia would be very interested in Iran's anti-terror approaches and vice versa. Russia has been subject to internal terror plots as its operation in Ukraine continues, including bombings in Moscow and drone attacks on civilian bridges. A skill share and an open line of communication between the two countries' intelligence forces could result in protected trade routes and corridors, as well as rooting out existing hostile forces. Furthermore, Iran's new military technology, that includes drones, missiles, and radar systems, are also highly attractive to Russia, and the Russians do not shy away from admitting this. During the meeting between the two sides, Shoigu inspected some of the latest Iranian military hardware, which is also notably on display in Moscow.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the representatives of the people from the provinces of Sistan and Baluchistan and Fars Khorasan. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 11, 2023. Today, despite the extraordinary development of information and security tools that U.S. possesses more than anywhere else, despite this, do you know of any country in the last 10 years whose government the U.S. has been able to overthrow and replace using hybrid warfare? They conspired in Syria for 10 years, but they were unable to do anything. They stayed around in Afghanistan for 20 years. They brought all their military tools. Yet, you saw how they exited Afghanistan in disgrace. This is what we mean when we say that the U.S. has become weak. That situation is not better when it comes to the decline that is taking place in Europe. Well, you must have heard about the situation in Africa these days. The countries that were under France's control are rising up one after another against France. The people are overthrowing the puppet governments imposed by France. Of course, their armies are busy, but the people support them. So the Western powers, which are headed by the US and followed by Europe, do not have the same power they once used to have. They are becoming weaker.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This weakness is increasing every day. New powers are also emerging that I don't want to mention the names of these powers for now. I don't want to get into that now. This is a great global transformation. Now, this transformation is currently taking place. As I said, when major global changes occur, nations and countries' officials must be vigilant. This is the situation we are in now. We need to be vigilant. When we say that the enemy is becoming weaker, this does not mean that they are incapable of plotting, that they cannot show hostile behavior, or that they cannot inflict harm. They can. They are busy plotting. We must not fall asleep. We must not become neglectful. What do I mean when I say we? I'm talking about our officials and the general public.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost.
Her voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Khaled Al-Kaisi is a Palestinian-Italian researcher and student of the Department of Oriental Languages and Civilizations at the Sapienza University of Rome. On August 31st, he was returning from a trip to Bethlehem with his wife and four-year-old child when the Israeli occupation forces arrested him at a checkpoint on the Jordanian border. Al-Kaisi has been detained without any formal charges since that day. On Thursday, hundreds of students from Sapienza University staged a demonstration against Israel's unlawful practice of detaining Palestinians indefinitely without charge or trial and Italy's inaction over the detention of Al-Kaisi.
Administrative detention by Israel must stop once and for all. Al-Kaisi risks being held in prison indefinitely if the Italian government doesn't take a firm position on the issue.
Al-Kaisi is currently being held at the Petah Tikva Interrogation Center that is notorious for torture and inhuman treatment. His detention has been extended to October the 1st over, quote, national security concerns. Some members of the Italian parliament have tabled a parliamentary inquiry on the illegal arrest and detention of Al-Kaisi by Israeli occupation forces. However, the Italian government has so far done nothing or very little to protect the rights of an Italian citizen unlawfully seized in front of his family.
I don't know for sure if there is a connection between Italy's government and the media, if our media are subjected to some form of pressure by the government. What I know is that the executive seems to be more interested in protecting its political interest rather than one of its citizens.
A latest report by the United Nations Special Coordinator for the Middle East has found that 1,264 Palestinians are currently held in administrative detention by Israel. The number, according to the UN envoy, is the highest in over a decade. Max Civili, Rome.
The health authorities in Afghanistan have reported a surge in the number of children and mothers suffering from malnutrition across the country. They blame international factors for current circumstances.
I think the U.S. sanctions and the blockade of Afghan assets, as well as cuts in UN funding, are deepening the economic and health crisis. These factors have caused poverty, malnutrition, and hunger among families.
One of the places where the impact of the crisis is most visible is the Indira Gandhi Hospital in Kabul, where hundreds of children are admitted every day with severe acute malnutrition. The hospital officials are appealing for more funding and support to cope with the situation.
As winter approaches, patients with seasonal diseases will be added to our malnourished ones. So there is a need for more support and attention to the hospital. The center needs medications, fuel and funds to remain operational.
Meanwhile, the World Food